Welcome to His Time. I'm your host, Andy Bates. It is time to study the Daily Lectionary. Our guest pastor joining us by phone this morning is the Reverend Aaron Rickert. He's pastor at St. John Lutheran Church in Fraser, Michigan. Good morning, Pastor Rickert. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing just fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. We're going to study Acts chapter 27 this morning, verses 27 through 44. But before we get into that, tell us about St. John Lutheran Church in Fraser, Michigan.
Well, St. John's a wonderful congregation. I've been here just over a year. We do offer a full school, preschool through eighth grade. We also have a nice festival in the winter for our Boar's Head, and it's a wonderful community of mostly blue-collar, but a lot of nice families, and feels like we're headed in a nice positive direction here.
Wonderful. Well, congratulations on being there a year and delivering God's good gifts to the folks there at St. John in Fraser, Michigan. We are studying Acts chapter 27, verses 27 through 44. Any background on the text you'd like us to understand before we get into our study?
Well, you know, I do think it's important to understand the narrative nature of this, and that, you know, one of the tricky things for pastors is preaching the narrative, because we can preach it allegorically, we can preach it drawing out some of the symbolism, but it is mostly, at its core, just the history of these events. And so we have to, as we read through this, keep in mind that, you know, Luke is recording these events for a reason, that there's some significance to them. But this is a historical account, and therefore it can be a little tricky at times to understand what application we can make from it, because these are obviously things that happened to Paul and to Luke, and they're not happening to us. So we have to understand, try to understand some of the greater themes about how God interacts with his people, and see how then we can apply that to our situation in the 21st century.
Very good. All right, we're in Acts chapter 27, verses 27 through 44. When the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, about midnight the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little farther on they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down four anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea, under pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved." Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. So the 14th night had come. They'd been on the sea for 14 nights, is that correct?
Right.
And they were being driven across the Adriatic Sea. What part of the world, what do we know about the Adriatic Sea and where they're traveling?
Well, we know that they're on their way to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as we can tell, there's a little bit of conversation about what their original port was. You know, they had just finished with Paul's trial in Caesarea. And so he's on his way to Rome because he had appealed to Caesar. And so they have to cross through the Mediterranean region, and they're getting there by boat. And so they're on their way to Rome for Paul's appeal. But what had happened was, on the way, they had taken port. I believe that the port was in Sidon. And Paul had encouraged them not to set out. He encouraged them to winter in the port that they were at because he feared that the sea would be unsuitable for travel. And then as the story plays out, as we just heard, he ended up being correct. And so this is in the middle of that narrative where Paul's being transported, but he had already spoken with the captain and with some of the sailors and the soldiers and encouraged them not to set out. And so the 14th night had come. This is the 14th night of storms. They've been in storms for 2 weeks, and finally the sailors are so fearful that they're looking for solutions now that they've sort of given up hope of survival and they're looking for another way to escape.
And perhaps a bit nauseous.
I would think so.
So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little farther on, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. Now, I'm gathering they didn't have the technology we have today. What do we know about this process of taking a sounding?
You know, I'm not 100% sure on that. I would assume that they had a rope of some kind.
Uh-huh.
They would have lowered into the ground or into the water. And as it hit the bottom, they would have been able to see, they're sort of dragging it along the bottom, and they're seeing where the rope is taut on the surface. And they're noticing, most importantly, that the water is getting shallower,
mm-hmm.
That they're being pushed in towards the land. The waves are pushing their boat. The boat is unable to fight the strength of the wind and the waves, and they're just sort of being pushed into shore with no brakes. Like you said, they don't have the technology to throw the engine in reverse to slow the boat down. So they're just being pushed in faster towards the shore, and they're starting to become fearful.
And fearing that we might run on the docks, they let down four anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. So they dropped the anchors and prayed for morning.
Yeah, I think they're just trying to stop the boat because the soundings they're taking are showing them that they're headed for a collision with something.
Yeah.
They're just trying to slow down any way they can.
And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under the pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved." So they're trying to get to escape from the ship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Their pretense is that they're laying out anchors, so that they go and they start working with the rigging, but either Paul overheard some of their plans, or Paul, just being a seasoned traveler as he was, I mean, you know, most of the people that are on this ship, aside from the sailors themselves, aren't going to be world travelers like Paul is, but obviously through his missionary journeys, we know that Paul had a lot of experience traveling. So somehow, he deduced that these guys are trying to get away, that they're not laying out anchors, they're trying to get on the lifeboats, and they're going to abandon us, and we're just going to be tossed around by the waves, and nobody's going to be here to guide the ship or to do anything. So he tells the centurion who's guarding him, who's been with him this whole trip, these guys are going to abandon us, and unless you know how to sail the ship, we're going to be in a bad spot, because Paul's not a sailor, the soldiers aren't sailors, and if the sailors all leave, there's nobody to guide the boat.
So they're going to be without a captain.
Exactly. Tossed around by the waves.
Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. So they cut off the lifeline to the lifeboats there.
I guess, you know, sort of removing the temptation. If the soldiers cut away the boats to cut away the ropes to the lifeboats, then nobody's tempted to get on the lifeboats because they're gone.
And anything else about that first paragraph before we go on to the next section?
There's, you know, it's interesting how at this point, especially at the end of that paragraph, you see sort of a change in the way that the centurion and some of the soldiers start listening to Paul. Luke doesn't make a big deal out of this, but some of the commentators picked up on this, where when Paul first gave his advice about not even setting out, they overlooked him, they didn't really want to listen to him, but now that he proves to be right, all of a sudden he's got some credibility with them, and they start listening to him, and he says, look, those guys over there are trying to escape, you might want to stop them. They act on that, so he's garnered some credibility with them, and they're starting to listen to what he has to say.
Verse 33. As day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that you have continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for it will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you." And when he had said these things, he took bread, and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves. We were in all 276 persons in the ship. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. All right, so as day was about to dawn, they're praying for day to come, and as day is about to break, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, this is the 14th day that you've continued in suspense and without food. You've been out here on the stormy sea, having taken nothing. Eat something.
Yeah, incredibly practical advice. You know, it's like you mentioned earlier, they're nauseous. This is the 14th day, not of their journey, but the 14th day of storms.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not eating because well, first of all, you can't cook. If the ship is being tossed around, there's no good way to prepare a meal. But then also, you probably don't want to eat. You're fearful for your life. You're worried about being tossed overboard. You're not thinking about sitting down and eating. You're worried about survival. But you know, 2 weeks without food really weakens the body. And Paul seems to know what's coming up ahead. You know, Paul seems to understand whether the angel had told him or whether he just figured it out, that they're going to be wrecked and they're going to need to swim to shore, that there's a bit of work ahead of them. They all better sit down and eat something so that they have the strength for what lies ahead. And so he just sort of does it. He sits down and he eats, and he encourages them all to eat too, so that they have strength for the challenge that they're going to face the next morning.
You know, you painted a good picture there, something that I could identify with or I could relate to. You know, they were so anxious in being tossed about by the storm that they couldn't do anything couldn't prepare food, much less did they eat. They were just so anxious and being tossed about in these storms. And I sometimes get that way when I fly. You know, it's so anxious about, you know, the turbulence and things like that, that I don't want to move. I don't want anybody to move.
Absolutely. or you get that way when a loved one or somebody is in the hospital and you're just sitting in the waiting room and somebody brings you food and says, you've got to eat something. And you think, oh, you know what? I never even thought about eating.
Yeah.
Just sitting here waiting for the situation to get better, and the thought of eating just never crosses your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of that's going on.
So they're being tossed about. He says, eat some food. Practical advice, because there's more to come.
Right.
That's not going to be, it's not going to be easy to do if you haven't eaten, if you're undernourished.
Right.
Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for it will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you. Is he being prophetic here?
Well, I suppose in the sense that the prophet is called to speak what God has spoken to him. Paul, you know, just before the verses of our reading today, which starts at verse 27, just before those verses, Paul is visited by an angel. And the angel tells Paul, this picks up in verse 21 or so, but the angel tells Paul in verses 24 and 25, you got to stand before Caesar. And Caesar's not out here in the middle of a storm on the Adriatic Sea. You've got to stand before Caesar, so fear not. You're not going to perish. You're going to make it through this. And the angel also tells him that the people on the boat with you are not going to perish. So, Paul at this point is delivering the message that he received. He finds confidence in knowing that he's going to survive, not because he's got a hunch, but because at this point he was visited by an angel. So he does have that confidence, and he is speaking to them the message that he received from God, from the angel.
So when he had said these things, he took bread, and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. So, okay, well, now I'm going to eat.
I think so. I think it's just sort of that simple. He's sort of relaying or inspiring confidence and calm in the other sailors and in the other prisoners and in the soldiers by being incredibly calm himself. He's got the inside information, so he's not worried about the outcome of the storm. He's not worried about the outcome of the night's watch, because he has the inside information and he believes it's true. He knows it to be true and he trusts it.
I'm no math genius and I'm not from the Department of Health, but we know that they've been in this condition for at least 14 days, and he takes some bread. They didn't really have the preservatives that we have today.
No, and it's probably a little soggy.
Yeah, it might be a little soggy. Who knows what the condition of that bread is like? I mean, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I know what bread looks like after it's been around for a week.
Well, I would assume they would have some sort of means for travel. I mean, they weren't the only people who ever sailed across the Mediterranean. So I'm sure they had some sort of plan in place. But, you know, the other thing that's going on here is that, which comes up at the end of the section there, they throw the wheat into the sea.
Mm-hmm.
They've already jettisoned everything they can. They got rid of all of the unnecessary weight on the boat to try to keep it on top of the waves, and about the last thing they have to get rid of to get over this last bout of the storm is the food. And you don't throw the food away first, obviously, because you need it. But it seems like they've gotten to the point where it's fish or cut bait. They figure that tomorrow's the last day, and so they eat, and then they throw the rest overboard.
So he gave thanks in the presence of all. He broke it and began to eat. Common to give thanks to God in the presence. It sounds this phrase sounds familiar, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, a lot of people hear in this phrase, especially the Greek word, is the Eucharist, that he is giving thanks and breaking bread. It does have sort of a aroma of the sacrament with it. But I would have a hard time arguing that he's actually observing Holy Communion here. I mean, he's on a boat with a bunch of, I mean, he's got a Luke and a few other traveling companions with him, but I'd have a hard time being convinced mm-hmm. that he was celebrating the Eucharist with Roman centurions and sailors who have not been who aren't believers. So
sure.
I do think he's just given thanks that in all circumstances he gives thanks. That's in his other writings. I mean, he writes that way,
mm-hmm.
and you see that in practice. He's learned how to handle any situation. He tells that to the Philippians, that I know how to be made low and I know how to be made high and exalted and humbled because through Christ I can do all things. And you sort of see that in practice here. It's not just in theory now. You're actually seeing an event in his life where he lives that out.
Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves. So they, okay, Paul's eaten, we'll eat too.
And again, I think that that's an indication of the fact that they're starting to view him with a little bit more confidence, or they're a little bit more trust in his actions and his words, because he seems to be right about everything else so far. And if he seems calm enough to sit down and eat, that they take confidence in that. They're encouraged by that, and they themselves take food.
We were in all 276 persons in the ship, and when they'd eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. 276 persons, that's no small group of people.
Yeah, you got a lot of sailors, you got some guards, you got the prisoners themselves. And so it is, you know, I'm not sure how big the boats would have been back then. I didn't get a chance to research that, but you know, 276 people is a fair number.
And then after they ate, after they'd eaten enough, they just threw out the wheat.
Yeah, well, I think that's connected to the taking the depth. They're getting shallower and shallower. They got to get the bottom of the boat a little higher up in the water. And the only thing they have left that's of any significant weight is their food provisions. So they've got to get rid of that so they're not scraping the bottom of the boat against the rocks in the bottom of the sea.
Hmm. Looking back over this section, anything else about this this paragraph where Paul encourages them to take some food and does so himself? Anything else that you'd like for us to learn from this text?
Well, I do think that even though it's a historical account, you know, the sea represents chaos, and we see that a lot in the scriptures where, you know, in the kingdom of paradise, the sea is calm before the throne of God. The chaos has been removed, and you see that with Jesus calming the storm on the sea. And I think that for Paul's traveling companions, they're going to be afraid of the gods of the sea. They're going to be afraid of the chaos of the sea. And to see Paul not afraid, to see Paul confident in his God's ability to deliver him from this chaos, I don't think that's insignificant for his companions. I think that might be something we gloss over, but I do think that's something that the people who are with him are going to be awestruck that he is so calm in the face of the impending disaster.
Calm in the chaos.
Yeah.
Sounds like a good theme.
Yeah, I think so.
We are studying the Daily Lectionary today. We're in Acts chapter 27, verses 27 through 44, studying with the Reverend Aaron Rickert. He's pastor at St. John Lutheran Church in Fraser, Michigan. We need to take a break. When we come back from that break, we'll continue studying our text. We're going to take a look at the shipwreck next. So stick around for more of his time right after this on listener-supported worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news. Hi, I'm Andy Bates. I invite you to join me weekdays at 10 a.m. for Faith and Family, where we talk with experts and everyday people about topics pertinent to faithful family life. Weekdays at 10 a.m. on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news, underwritten by Concordia University, Wisconsin.
A lifestyle that's everything a retirement should be, and one that's within your budget. Lutheran Senior Services offers 9 locations for rent-subsidized affordable housing for older adults in the greater St. Louis area. From the heart of the city to the tranquility of the countryside, Lutheran Senior Services affordable housing apartments surround seniors with close friends, friendly staff, and opportunities for supportive services. Learn more at lssliving.org.
Welcome back. back to His Time. I'm your host, Andy Bates. We are studying the Daily Lectionary today with the Reverend Aaron Rickert. He's pastor at St. John Lutheran Church in Fraser, Michigan. We're in Acts chapter 27 today, verses 27 through 44. Pastor, are we ready to press on to the text about the shipwreck?
Sounds good. Let's do it.
All right. Now, we're at verse 39. When it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes that tied the rudders. Then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow stuck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept him from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land, and the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship, and so it was that all were brought safely to the land. Now here we have a messy situation. It was day, and they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore.
Right, and this would be the island of Malta. And they still actually call it St. Paul's Bay. That's the name of it down there, and because they could see now, they saw the place that they thought they could safely lodge the ship and get out of the big storm, and so they cut anchors and went for it. You know, once you cut them, you can't get them back.
Yeah.
So this was it. This was their mad dash for the finish line.
They cast those anchors off, left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes and tied the rudders, and then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. So they're setting everything up to push them right in.
Right, they're just going to let the waves and the water push them right into this bay, and at that point, trying to just run it on ground so they can get out.
But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow stuck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. So their plan didn't work as they had hoped.
not quite as they were hoping. They sort of sideswiped the reef on the way in and ended up not making it safely into the bay where they could just drift up onto the beach, but ended up stuck, sort of in the chop still.
Now, the soldiers had planned to kill the prisoners, lest anyone should swim away and escape. But the centurion, well, let's talk about their plan first. Why would the soldiers plan to kill the prisoners?
It's because the soldier is responsible for that prisoner. And if the prisoner escapes, the soldier forfeits his life. That any escaped prisoner was grounds for that soldier being executed for failing his duty. And so since these are prisoners, the soldiers are much more comfortable killing the prisoners rather than taking the chance they escape. There's a lot of speculation that the prisoners who are on the ship with Paul are, in large part, since they're on the way to Rome, that in large part these are prisoners who are being taken to the Colosseum for gladiatorial games or for the, you know, Roman entertainment to be fed to the animals and that kind of thing. And so to the soldiers themselves, they're sort of expendable, that they're not going to risk their own lives or their own careers for these people who are just being transported to Rome to be executed in the gladiator games anyway.
But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. Why did the centurion want to save Paul?
You know, that is sort of the million-dollar question in this part of the text here. There's as many guesses as there are commentaries out there, it seems like. Some people would say that it's because the centurion has been Paul's traveling companion the whole time, and that they've sort of bonded, that they've had this relationship that's grown over time since the one centurion is responsible for getting Paul to Rome, that they've had conversations, they've shared meals, that they sort of built a friendship, and the centurion doesn't want to see Paul executed. Others would say that it's simply because of Paul's stature, that he's not just going to Rome to be put in the Colosseum, that he's going to meet with Caesar, and that if he doesn't show up, that there's going to be sort of some fallout from that or some consequences for not getting this particular prisoner, Paul, safely to Rome. And then because of Paul's reputation, because he's sort of built a name for himself, both positively and negatively, with his travels, it would be sort of not well received if he doesn't make it safely to Rome. I don't know which one of those I think is accurate, and I can't read the centurion's mind, but I sort of think it's because of Paul's stature. I think that the centurion realizes that also with Paul's on the journey so far with being right about the storm and then his confidence in eating the night before, as we just talked about. I think the centurion and the other soldiers recognize that there's something unique about this individual, and they're not ready to just execute him sort of happenstance. He told them they would all survive. They've all survived. He told them the storm was coming. The storm came. I think that they're just not ready to discard him.
So he ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land, and the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship.
Yeah, and that's a bold move. That's a lot of trust that the centurion is placing in these prisoners. Any of the prisoners, any of the soldiers who can jump overboard and swim are told to do that. And he's trusting that they're not going to try to swim away. I don't know where they would go, obviously. I mean, they're still in a small island in the middle of the sea. So maybe he's banking on the fact that even if they do escape, they're escaping to an island and it can be tracked back down. But it is, I mean, it's still sort of he's putting his neck on the line by letting these prisoners, along with the soldiers who can swim, jump over the side of the ship and go to the land. And then also the other players involved, the people who can't swim, who are riding the shipwreck, riding the debris into shore. But I suppose from his perspective, maybe if they do try to escape and try to swim back or float back into the sea, that they're probably going to end up dead anyway. So I sort of think he's taking a risk, but I guess you could also say he's just calculating the odds of the situation and deciding it's better off to let everybody try to swim to shore.
And so it was that all were brought safely to land. So here we have, well, it's kind of, I would say it's the end of the story, but it's not. There's more after this.
Right.
So they all made it safely.
Yeah, and Paul was right. I think that's what that boils down to. And I think that's where the story becomes applicable and pertinent, especially, yeah, obviously, getting from the trial to before Felix to Rome, that's a significant part of Paul's overall story in the book of Acts, and the narrative involved there. Getting Paul to Rome was an important part of that, and if he got shipwrecked on the way, that's not an insignificant detail. That is part of the story that obviously Luke would want to share, because that doesn't just happen all the time that people survive this kind of shipwreck. But I also do think that the fact that nobody was hurt, that nobody was harmed, and that Paul had sort of prophesied or predicted that, relayed that information in advance, again, goes to the credibility of Paul, that he is not just guessing and making these things up, that he does, in fact, speak messages from God that God has given him to speak. And so then that then gives credibility and weight to his other messages that he's speaking, both about Jesus being Messiah and to the Gentiles. It increases his stature before them. I think that's part of the reason that these details like this are included, that all 276 persons survived and made it to land. That just shows that something's going on with Paul that's worth taking note of.
Looking back over the text as a whole today, Pastor, what can we learn from this text? You pointed out in that first paragraph, certainly some things we can learn, but as a whole, is there anything that you think we can, certainly this is a historical account, as you pointed out earlier, is there anything else we can learn from this as a whole?
Well, I think there's really two things, and I think they're sort of from different perspectives. The one is, I talked about Paul's credibility. Paul's going to Rome. This is his first time going to Rome. He's going to meet the Roman Christians. We have the book of Romans, so we know he's been in correspondence with them, but his first time going to meet them, and he's going in chains. He's going as a prisoner. He's going with an armed guard escort because he's under house arrest, and the fear of them rejecting him or rejecting his message on the basis of his circumstance, on the basis of his arrest, I do think that that's a very legitimate fear for him. I think that's something that he was worried about, and so I think that Luke including these stories of Paul gaining the trust and the respect of his traveling companions and of the centurions, and having these instances where there's this miraculous intervention that validates Paul as an apostle, that validates his message, I do think that's something significant, because I do think that Christians of any generation, Christians of any time, are always faced with credibility challenges. Where I look at myself as a pastor, and I pray that the sinfulness of my person, the sinfulness of my life, doesn't get in the way of the Word of God that I'm trying to proclaim. And so I think for any Christian who faces that fear, we take confidence in the way that Paul handled it, which was simply to relay the word that he was given. You know, Paul was given it directly by vision from an angel. I've been given it through the scriptures, through the teaching that I've had professors and my parents and my Sunday school teachers, and you know, I've been given this teaching. So my call is to convey the words that I've been given, and I think that there's comfort in that. That even when a man in chains is able to deliver the gospel, even a sinful man like myself is able to deliver the gospel, that's because the words themselves are doing the work, and the message is what's important. The messenger is the mouthpiece, but the Holy Spirit is working through those words to do incredible things, and so there's a comfort for us there, even in the midst of our own sinfulness, that we can still be the voice and God's mouthpiece to this culture, to this generation, to this world today.
Amen to that.
Yeah. The other thing that I sort of find interesting and striking about this is the place that it has within the larger story. I mean, the account of Paul's time on Malta itself is incredible, where he's surviving a snake bite and the people's response to him, where it's, the gods are getting him because the snake bit him. So he survived the shipwreck, but he must be a murderer because the snake bit him. But then he survives the snake bite. So then all of a sudden now they think he's a god. And through it all, through the ups and the downs, through the tosses and the turns, Paul trusts the words that were given to him. And I think that there's a call for us in that too. That through the shipwreck, through the storm, through the snake bite, I mean, all of it. Paul finds his confidence in the words that were given to him, and I think that that's definitely a theme or an application that we can easily make to our lives as God's children today. That we've been given promises in baptism, and the promises don't necessarily tell us that life in this fallen world is going to be easy. They don't tell us that life in this fallen world is going to be always even comfortable. But they do tell us that we are redeemed, and that we are redeemed for paradise, and that we can find comfort in that even in the midst of whatever challenges we face. And I think that that's also part of why Luke relays this story in the way that he does. He's very poetic in this section, and he sort of makes allusions to the sea and the chaos and the enemy and like the book of Jonah with the sea, and there's all kinds of chaotic seas in the scriptures, but in this one, in the midst of the chaos, Paul finds comfort and calm in the promise he was given, the word that he was given. And I think that's the call for us, that as the culture around us, as the world around us seems to grow more and more chaotic, and we might even feel like we're being tossed around more.
And nauseous,
yeah. That, you know, we take our confidence in the words that we have been given. We study those words, we cling to those words, we pray those words, we trust those words, and that's where we're able to sit and eat in the midst of the storm, to deal with sort of the practical nature of what's ahead. We don't just wring our hands and say, oh my gosh, I can't think of what's going to happen next. How can it get any worse? No, like Paul, we sit down, we take something to eat, because there's work to do tomorrow too. So you find comfort in the words you've been given, and you prepare yourself for whatever our Lord puts before us tomorrow. We sit down and we eat, and we take it each day as it comes. And I think that there's a nice application in there for us too.
We've been studying the Daily Lectionary with the Reverend Aaron Rickert. He's pastor at St. John in Fraser, Michigan, and we've been in Acts chapter 27 today. Pastor Rickert, thanks so much for helping us study the Daily Lectionary.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a real treat.
The same here. It's been a joy to study with you, and God's blessings to you and all the saints at St. John Lutheran Church in Fraser, Michigan.
All right, thank you. God bless.